everybody. Pleasure to have you here. Welcome to the LSE, welcome to the old building, welcome to this public event hosted by the Geography Department as part of its public series in sustainability. My name is Olmo Silva. I am a professor of real estate economics and finance here at the London School of Economics at the Department of Geography and Environment. I'm very pleased to have Andrei, Martina, and Hyun here on the stage with me. I'm very excited to have three colleagues that are going to give us this wonderful evening of remarks on creative use of the cities. Andrei Hibik is a founding partner of Hibik and Christoph Architects. It's a studio specializing in urban transformation and architecture with offices in London, Prague, Brno, and Bratislava. Martina Manara is a lecturer in urban planning at the Bartlett School of Planning, an associate at the Center for Economic Performance here at the LSE. Is also one of our former graduate students, so it's a pleasure to have her back. She's also the coordinator of the Urbanization and Development Study Group of the Development Studies Association in the UK. And last but not least, we have Hyun Shin, who's a professor of geography and urban studies, also the head of the Department of Geography and Environment. So he's actually my boss for any other matter. It's a pleasure today to have Andrei with us today. He's going to explore with us how cities can evolve sustainably through creative use, balancing progress with preservation. He's got about 40 minutes to go, and then he'll be followed by some remarks by Martin and Hyun for about 5 to 7 minutes each. And after that, we will open the floor for questions. The event is being recorded, and all being well with technical instruments and appliances, it's going to be released as a podcast later on. And when we open up the session for Q&As, I'll make sure that I collect a few questions before allowing Andrei, Martina, and Hyun to reply, and I'll send around a microphone. Raise your hands and make sure you also tell us who you are. Maybe just say your name and your background before stating your question. And I'll leave the floor to Andrei. Thank you very much for being here. He's been traveling around as usual, but he's made the time for this great event. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Almo. Thank you very much. It's an honor and pleasure. Good evening. I just came from Vienna, but I live in Brno. Are you familiar? What is it? Brno is the second largest city in Czech Republic. I live there, and the vast majority of our practice is based there. And since 2 years, we are also actively here, actively working here in London. And today's lecture is about our past 15 years and about the topic of creative use of cities. And I would like to explain first what does it mean. Our cities are not static. They are living systems shaped by history, culture, and the way people live in them. As cities grow, the needs of their communities change too. But too often, this change means destroying what's already there. Buildings are torn down, streets are rebuilt, and the unique identity of a place gets lost. Today, we know we can't keep doing this. The construction industry is responsible for around 38% of global CO2 emissions. Instead of tearing things down and starting from scratch, we need to focus on using what we already have. This helps not only the environment, but also keeps the memory and a character of our cities alive. But reuse shouldn't be just a technical task. It's not only about saving materials. It should also protect the story, the atmosphere, and the soul of a place. So we ask, how can we make reuse creative? How can we transform spaces while keeping what makes them meaningful? There are, however, cases when preservation or reuse is simply not possible. When materials are too damaged to fix, when urban needs evolve, or when history itself is layered with erasure. In these cases, how do we balance progress and memory? How do we build anew without repeating mistakes of the past? And can demolition too be an act of creative continuity? For the past 15 years, we've explored what we have come to call a creative reuse of cities, which operates along a spectrum of interventions, from retrofitting and adaptive reuse to reimagining spaces and even buildings anew. We see it as a way to improve urban life, by renewing neighborhoods, adding public spaces, bringing back forgotten heritage, or creating buildings that serve many functions and spark change in whole districts. We, as practicing architects, we do understand the built environment as a gradient from preservation through adaptive reuse, reimagination, or building anew. And this lecture is about how do we work within this gradient. First project I'd like to share tonight is Zvonarka bus station. It's the largest bus station in our hometown, which is a public facility, privatized in 90s in Czech Republic or Czechoslovakia formerly. There was a Velvet Revolution in 1989, and then there was a decade of wild, we call it wild 90s, wild privatization. And many of public facilities were privatized, and that was our initial moment when we started to think how is possible that a public space, public facility, which serves over 1 million passengers a year, and in the size of one Barcelona block, on the left side is the bus station. It's actually covered public plaza with parking spaces for buses on top of the structure, in the size of Barcelona block, designed and built in 1985, as I was born in the same year. And our question was, how is it possible that such an important facility looks like this? So we started our internal investigation, and we realized that this public facility was privatized, and the owner is unfortunately not earning enough money to properly maintain the structure. And we knew that if we would like to make a change for the passengers, to increase the safety in the space through a much lighter environment and many other aspects, we have to be very conscious of budget. So we almost did nothing. We just designed lights. Lighting system, which is not lighting down, but also up. And we paint the structure by a white light color. And the change was dramatic. It was really important project of our studio, because suddenly it was not just about increasing the quality of the public space, but it was also increasing the perception and improving the perception of the building as a whole, because it's actually beautiful. It's a building from 80s, and this is our very important story to mention, because we know that globally, or at least here in Europe, buildings from 80s are usually considered as something what has no beauty, has no atmosphere or essence of quality, but we do not agree with this. So this project was really important to save the building, and to while using almost no financial resources to increase the quality of the space. In front of the building, facing the city center, there were these temporary boxes built also in 90s for temporary usage. They were left there for 30 years. We managed to demolish them, so sometimes you have to work with demolition to increase the quality and to increase the urban appearance. And instead of these temporary boxes for low quality retail units, we just made this new entrance hall, which is actually we freed the corner to see the beautiful structure of the original building, and also that you can enjoy the view towards the bus station. And you are aware that there's a bus station, that's it's not some back of the house. Some similar story, but much bigger scale, is our study to a tower built in late 60s in Broadway, on the 50th Street on Manhattan. It's a building which is in the center of a business district of Manhattan, and in this very clear, on this clear scheme, we can observe how people live and work on this island. And from the building is somewhere here. So from this, okay, I can show you this one. Yeah. So it's a very monofunctional area. It's just an office building, commercial office spaces, without any housing. And if so, it's just housing in this super tall, very exclusive apartments, apartment buildings, but without the layer of regular and I would say affordable housing units is completely missing there. The building is, in our understanding, is beautiful. It's inspired by Miss van der Rohe's architecture. It's built in 1970, and it has certain beauty, and we just like it. We just love it, actually. So the question was how to bring a new life, a new function in this tower. How to create the vertical neighborhood out of this monofunctional commercial office space building, and how to spark a change. So this building became completely vacant during COVID period and after COVID period, and entire Manhattan Central Business District was hit by the COVID vacancy the most, and the streets were empty and the shops started to close their shops as well. So the ground floor doesn't work anymore, and these monofunctional territories, these CBD Central Business Districts, are as far as they are monofunctional, they are very. They are there's always quite low resistance to changes. So our goal was to create very contemporary space for work, but also small scale units. Therefore, more affordable than this huge floor place in these super towers, super tall towers, and the mixture of housing, co-living, and co-working was an idea how to increase the multifunctionality of the of this building. We work on the scheme with Thornton Tomasetti, with their New York branch, structural engineers to create this structural scheme as workable. Of course, it's expensive. Of course, it's quite challenging to build such a cave in an existing building, but it's possible. And our goal was to keep as much as possible from the existing one. So even the small elements which were removed during the which were meant to be removed during the refurbishment, were at the end of the day installed as elements of future apartments. We worked with the facade, with an exterior, interior spaces, and the appearance was kept as much as possible while during the night the change was quite dramatic. Regeneration of entire existing neighborhood. This is something what we love the most within within our architecture work, and working in very urban areas is very rewarding, because it's not exclusive, it's very inclusive. The goal of the practice is to create spaces for all, and we had an opportunity to work simultaneously on two projects which are neighboring each other. It's a new square, newly introduced square within existing neighborhood, and it's a cultural building in very contemplative environment as a contemporary extension of a monastery built in 16th century. And this entire area has a famous name. It's Johann Gregor Mendel. And Johann Gregor Mendel is the figure behind the genetics, behind the genetics as a whole industry. He was the father of genetics, and in this particular place, he did his first research on the bees, these genetical mothers, sisters, brothers, daughters, these bees researches. Mendel Square. Mendel Square wasn't square. It was a place where you could change the transport, public transport, from buses to trolleybuses, from trolleybuses to trams. It was full of barriers and obstacles. There was no. It was. It had no. It has no destinational potential. It was just to change from one to another, and our trick was to work with an existing scheme, but we erased this little piece of grass, which was actually never used for anything than just as it functioned just as a barrier. And while moving these trolley bus stops towards the left, as you can see here, that's the actual drone picture, we freed the space and it became a central plaza. Squares are very important for Czech society because we gained democracy on squares. Without squares, there wouldn't be democracy. All the protests, all the demonstration in the 90s were happening on squares. And I'm super happy and proud that we had an opportunity to work with our fellow architect from Dielna studio on this project, because it made a very dramatic change. The original condition of this space was looked like this even 4 years ago. It was full of obstacles, full of railings, full of barriers, full of trash bins without any sense placed in the elsewhere. Facing beautiful building of a brewery, Czech's brewery, you know how we function. So. But while working within this territory, we made this happen, and it was really a huge change for the city. That's the magic and power of architecture and urban planning, that you can, while working with the same, change a lot. This roof is the greenhouse I will talk about later. So just to let you know where how are these two projects related. Why is there a circle? Circle is not for birds, circle is for people. Circle is the only shape you could, as a pedestrian, understand from the horizon and as something central. So there's always a sense of coming and leaving, and everything what's inside the circle is red, everything what is outside the circle is neutral, is gray. So as you can see here, our goal was to increase the centrality, the perception of the central space, central plaza, as much as possible. So the circle was actually very helpful shape to increase this. And this is the same angle. This is the picture before the refurbishment, and this is what's happening there. Even a protest was there. There are some gatherings of local community, and I'm really happy how does it work, because it's really important to consider architects, to dedicate architects' work not just to the beauty of the window shapes of the windows, but also to the logic of the public spaces. How to plant trees inside the cities? Cities are very unpleasant for trees. There are some figures how many trees will survive first 3 years of their life in urban environments, but there's a quite new and we test it and it works obviously and there's a quite new science behind the trees' roots systems. And if you create the channels under the pavement, you can let the roots of the trees grow next to each other, and once they touch each other, they are more strong together. They are intelligent enough to find their way and to increase their resistance and to support each other in this very urban territory. So, and that's the original condition, and that's the new one. So, Mendel's greenhouse. This is very busy. This is very busy place. It still works as the main public transportation hub of the city, and it's a little bit contradictory to create a destinational elements and elements where you have to quickly change from tram to bus and trolleybus. So it's destinational, as you saw on the picture with the of the people having a lunch there. But the contemplative space, as an opposite, is just behind the wall of the monastery. The wall is listed. And the monastery is a contemporary extension of the monastery building built in the 16th century, originally. And it was designed and to be flexible, to be as flexible as possible, to serve as a shed during the day when there's no event, and to serve as a space for lectures, as this one, exhibitions, etc., etc. The last event I've seen there was tattoo festival. So there were beds, and people were lying on the beds and getting new tattoos. Not just crosses. The church is quite open-minded these days. And it's also a very personal project for me, because in this window I started my art classes when I was 6, so I was really happy that the Abbey awarded our studio by this project. There was a building, and this is about the atmosphere and memory I spoken about in the abstract, where that's the original greenhouse where Johann Gregor Mendel did his research. It's not Johann Gregor Mendel. He died before the invention of the photograph thing, I think. But that's it's some of his offsprings. This is the original greenhouse. And that was the status for almost a century. Just the foundations were kept. And the foundations were also listed. So we worked with the footprint of the original greenhouse, but we also worked with the shape of the roof a little bit. We got inspired by, and the goal was to create very transparent and translucent pavilion in the middle of the park, which is open to the public, and you can rent the space, or the monastery is running their activities there. But mostly it's rented to third parties. It's shaded. To build a completely glazed building in 21st century is almost a crime. But if you work with external shading, there's even in the summer, where we sometimes have in Czech, we have 35 degrees. There's no need for air condition, because it's just shaded by these external textile elements. And there's also very very unusual relationship of this huge tree and the building. If there wouldn't be these existing foundations of the original greenhouse, it wouldn't be possible to build such a building in such a close manner of this tree. So the existing foundations were the trick how we could erect a building next to the tree in such a close manner. So even the tree is nicely shading the greenhouse. This is how it's open, and there was an exhibition of an artist, local artist, and this is what I was talking about, these like shadings and how the ventilation goes up, etc., etc. We do lots of living. And unfortunately, we came to this territory after all the original buildings from of the brownfield were demolished. The previous owner of this plot unfortunately smashed all the buildings down. So there was no chance to keep much. There was only this one kept. But it's one of our early projects. We got a wild card by the client to participate in the competition. We were like 27, 26 years old, 2 years after school, and we won this scheme. So the goal was to create a shared green living room in the middle of the territory, which is car-free. It serves as a living room for not just the local community, but also surrounding neighborhoods. And it's also connected to this to this green spine coming from the very far nature to the city of Prague. So it's becoming a part of this. It's not a bio corridor, but it's a green corridor coming through the site. And it works like it's a built master plan, and it's nothing super exclusive. We worked with five different typologies to attract as many as possible groups of residents, and we work also with five different public spaces as a square, as a forest, as a park, as semi-public and semi-private spaces and streets inside the project. Completely different side is our second housing project, which is actually balancing gentrification. This is a social housing. We won a competition organized by the city, and their goal was to create a balance out of gentrified territory. This site is just facing the city of Brno, and this is a block structure, and it was the only no-go zone in our city for many years. It wasn't proper no-go zone, but there were some problems with drugs and crime. I wouldn't call it no-go zone anymore, even back then. But the image of this neighborhood was somehow broken. And today, what's happening? There's happening a dramatic gentrification. Lots of private developers are building, buying for nothing, and building for and building their projects, including us on neighboring side. We have another project for private developer. But this is for the city, and it's in the heart of one of the biggest blocks. It's a block structure, and the block is the biggest block by far within the neighborhood. And instead of building just a few apartment blocks and thinking it's enough, we took this as an opportunity to increase the pedestrian permeability across the block. So you suddenly get much higher traffic, but you can also increase the permeability through such a big block, which is actually blocking the streams from north to south. And as you can see, this is the city center, so it's really nearby. And the energy of the district is actually lovely. It's something what is really beautiful and charming. There are some problems, but I'm really happy to. This is they call it ghetto fest. What is kind of rough name for this neighborhood? But I think it's really important to preserve this atmosphere there and to preserve the energy we have in this neighborhood. So instead of building just like flat facades with big windows, we were inspired by the traditional exterior corridors. These are more loggias than corridors, but it's about blurring the edges. It's about like bringing something live on the facade as well. And the courtyard is publicly accessible, and it's a much smaller scale of the previous project, but it's also a place where you could gather and you could enjoy the exterior space. Even the corridors and these little boxes are the cores, the vertical cores, which are not just stairs and lifts, but are spaces for gathering inside. So you can use these spaces as an amenities for your families, because the apartments are not anything luxury. They are, the city is willing to have something very compact. So even the answer of an architect to the compact typology is to have an opportunity to open these walls and to increase the connectivity of the space. So suddenly it's more flexible, and you can feel the size of the apartment, not the size of the single rooms. So this is how it could work in some drawings. And that's housing. And last two projects, which are, we are slowly coming from doing almost nothing with these lights and these like brutalist structures from 80s, 70s and 80s, to building anew. And we have a project which is very rural, but we call it rural urbanity, because Czech Republic, Czechia, has a quite interesting feature in terms of number of villages and cities. We have the highest amount of villages and cities across the country, even higher than more than twice than Germany. So the distance of the villages is the shortest. Just the Malta is beating us because it's like a completely populated island, right? This is something was also a driver for the project, where we were asked by a wine producer to build a winery in the middle of countryside. And the winery was, in the brief, there was written, okay guys, we need this production facility for our production, and we would like to have also some little restaurant and bar and offices for our guests. And our idea was to bring an extra element in the middle, and that's an amphitheater for 1,000 people. And as far as we have the population is living in this rural environment, and the villages are just everywhere around. People are even walking here. It's not completely depend on cars, but people from surrounding villages, neighbor by neighbor, are walking here and walking back home. And this is something what is also a magic of architecture. This is the beauty of what we could create if we have. If we are thinking a little bit the way which is in our understanding contemporary. few shots from, and then it's architecture, of course. It has to be solid, beautiful, blah blah blah. It's the easy part. We like to work with artists, so there's a paint on the ceiling inspired by the colors of the terroir, etc. And the last project, is it too long already?
No, it's fine, you got 5 minutes.
5 minutes, thank you. So, 5 minutes for this project. It's a multipurpose arena in a city of Jihlava, which is 50,000 inhabitants. It's a small city in the heart of the country, and there was very clever decision by politicians. One of the local politicians is an architect, and he was so persuasive that he persuaded the rest to keep the arena inside the city. There was a 25 years long debate if the arena should stay in the city, reachable by pedestrians and public transportation, or if they will move it away of the city on the greenfield and build anew from the scratch. So, therefore, the project is very important within the topic of creative use of cities, because the decision to keep this arena inside the city was the major one and the most important one. The capacity is 6,000 seats. We have only 100 parking places under the arena necessary for trainings, etc. But the rest is serviced by public transport and by feet. So, that's the power of politicians. If they have architecture education, or they have a sense of planning. The arena has been built pretty recently. It's a It's a fifth month of after opening. It's a very urban arena, one of the most urban arenas of this size I recently know. It's facing a park, which is facing the historical core, medieval core of the city. On this side is facing the street and Faculty of Management. And our goal was to keep two existing buildings, a training hall and some office spaces, and to introduce two new spaces, which is actually arena, and a corner building full of amenities like a restaurant, accommodation, training hall, and training hall connected with via bridge to the running track. The training hall is occupied by the local schools and gymnasiums, so they train inside and they run outside, but the running track is also publicly accessible, and it's an extension of public space. The park is 6 meters higher than the street, so in this space in the middle, we were able to reintroduce the same trick as we did in the winery, this amphitheater, and the logic behind the urban scheme is very simple. The goal was to create a covered plaza, a new square, new center, in the middle of the city, where you can enter from all directions. The facade facing the park and the street is completely glazed and completely open, so you can see what's happening inside. And on this level, it's the concourse, where you can walk and meet your neighbors. So it's very socially driven place. It's funded by public money, so it's nothing exclusive. It's not funded by some rich oligarch. It's a collection of cities, city government, regional government, and central government collected the 80 million euros to invest in this piece of infrastructure. And we were selected through anonymous architecture competition. So the transparency and the chance that even young practice without much experience in sports is trustable and capable to design and then to help to build this such a facility is a very good sign of the scene. I think we won the scheme because instead of building one huge block, we took these two existing into the game, and these two new we just added as an extension. So the training hall was kept, and the new main hall was built. And there was also a very important aspect of urban layering. So the arena is not at the corner. It's not visible on very first hand, but it's hidden by this corner building, which is much taller and architecturally similar. The space in the middle, something similar we've seen at the winery, and here is a screen. Today there is a screen and you can watch the Olympics. Even it's freezing, people are coming and watching Olympics. And it's very socially connected to the local community. The corner building, the triangles are coming from the Gothic origins of the city. The city of Jihlava was the richest and most important city during the period of mining silver. So they were really, really rich. So the Gothic elements are all across the city. These triangles are in the architecture, in the paintings, on the walls, etc., etc. So we were searching for local authentic architecture expressions. So it's translated into this building. But the city is, it's a sophisticated explanation of the architecture form. But there's also something much softer, and even little children could understand, and that's that it's not just a crown, but the city's symbol is a hedgehog, and it's red. So I'm really happy that we managed to build this in this like a very understandable way, because I think architecture shouldn't be like super exclusive. This is a shot from the park. This is completely glazed and transparent. And here on the section, a few more slides, here on the section, you can see the relationship of the main arena on the concourse, how you can see inside what's happening. Even this small window was invented by us. We were not touching the existing arena, the existing training hall, but we persuaded the city to introduce windows to have this visual connection with the training hall as well. And here's the mix of shop, restaurant, facing the stairs. So if you get a beer, you can sit on the stairs, very urban, almost Italian inspiration. Two floors of accommodation, a gym, and another gym connected via bridge to the running track. So that's the scheme at all. And the logistics across the floor plan is super simple. Here's the park, and you enter this corridor, this concourse, this colonnade, and you're suddenly inside the hall. Super simple. You are never get. I spent so many. I've been a few times in San Siro, getting a beer, and losing the match, like completely losing the goals, because I was behind the tribunes, and the beer you get the beer behind the tribune, so you can see the match at all. So this is different here, and of course it's an arena. It's and it's multi-purpose. It's not just for ice hockey. We lost this today against Canada, so crying. There was a Davis Cup last week. We won, and it's becoming a symbol of the city, new symbol. And the project I'm the most proud is the project of the studio. These young colleagues are working with me together alongside with Michal Krzysztof, and it's sometimes fun. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Andrei. Besides the San Siro, I think many other neighborhoods in London could benefit from your insightful views on how to recreate space. And the place where I live in Wimbledon, Saturday, much better. Definitely fantastic lecture. Now calling Martina and Hume to give their reactions. About 7 minutes each, and after that, we can open the floor for your questions. Martin, you're up first, whatever you want, whichever way you prefer.
Okay, I can stay here. Okay, so I was very, very pleased to be invited here, and for several weeks, I've been wondering why did they invite me to be a discussant, because I don't know, it's such a pleasure to be here. I guess the reason is because in a past life, I was an architect. I trained as an architect before switching into the creative side of regulations, as I like to think of it. But after being here and attending this presentation, I must tell you, I've been wondering a lot, why on earth did I leave architecture? It looks so much fun. I regret it, I miss it. So my journey has been one that led me to shift from focus on the design of buildings onto the design of policies and regulations and institutions more generally, particularly focusing on urbanism in African cities, which is a context to some extent very far away from the projects we have been seeing today. But hopefully, I think I will be able to contribute with a few points to this conversation on creative reuse. So the first thing I would like to mention is that when we talk about creative reuse in Europe, for example, we often frame it as an alternative between demolition and preservation as a sustainable, thoughtful choice in the face of the climate crisis. However, in many other parts of the world, maybe the majority, creative reuse is not a choice, and it's not even the work of professionals. It is the default condition or the predominant mode of urbanization. So I'm thinking, for example, about cities like Dar es Salaam, 7 million inhabitants, the largest cities of Tanzania, where I've done research for over 8 years. Here, the majority of neighborhoods have been built incrementally. A house begins as a single-story structure, and then it builds, another floor is added over time, and then suddenly the courtyard becomes a shop or a rental unit gets added, and streets shift functions continuously without any design or redesign. So buildings adapt not because an architect has reimagined them, but because this is what livelihoods and societal change require. In that sense, creative reuse is not just innovation. It is also innovation, but is also how cities grow spontaneously. This incremental urbanism produces cities that are layered rather than replaced. So one of the findings we consistently see in our research on the implementation and effects of urban planning in Tanzania is that formalization or housing programs, planning programs, do not manage almost ever to wipe away what came before them. Instead, planned and unplanned forms of living continue to coexist, they overlap, they hybridize, and they interpret one another. So something I've learned from African urbanism, but something that I was very happy to see also in these projects, is that urban transformation is rarely about choosing between erasure or preservation. It is mostly about negotiating layers of histories, layers of cultures, layers of communities, layers of ways of living, which I think we have seen coming together, coexisting, and co-evolving in many of these projects. The second quick point that I would like to make is about the importance of adaptability to addressing crisis. So we have seen so beautifully in these slides how the city takes place, materiality, it takes a concrete shape, and every day we experience the city as something that is concrete and somehow polished, an architectural product. But on the other side, we have also seen in these slides how the city is and will forever be an unfinished project that can and in fact should evolve with societal change. So for example, think about the vertical neighborhood where co-living is made to coexist with co-working. So recently I've read a book from a colleague of mine which is called Adaptable Cities and Temporary Urbanism. I will keep it so short because I know this is way more interesting. I would like to make a point that this book provides plenty of examples from all over the world about experimentation and creativity being crucial for the present and the future of our cities. So, for example, I would say that the creative reuse that we have seen in these projects have combined the complex and potentially conflicting goals of both progress and preservation, which may sometimes be not so usefully conceived as a binary, but may not be so opposite to each other. So this brings me back to the issue of climate change. We know that the construction industry is responsible for a substantial share of global emissions. We know we cannot continue to just demolish and rebuild from scratch indefinitely. But climate resilience is not only about carbon metrics, obviously, as we have seen, it is also about social resilience, about ensuring that interventions do not undermine the very communities that make urban life work in a way or another. So demolition can be environmentally costly, this for sure, but redevelopment can also be socially costly. What we often see in urban planning is that well-intentioned interventions designed to modernize, upgrade, rationalize, regenerate areas can unintentionally, or sometimes intentionally, erode existing social and economic systems. So it doesn't happen every time that there is this sensitivity about encouraging sociality, collective life, and people coming together, cultures being indeed respected and integrated into the new urban fabric, like we have seen in the social housing project here, in the shared living room project here. Now, so obviously when I hear about the phrase preserving the soul of the city, I think not only of facades or historic materials, but also about the people and the social infrastructures that make cities long before planners or architects arrive. So I will conclude with a series of critical questions, which I hope may be stimulating for all of us and the audience, who I imagine being students and urban professionals such as architects, planners, and so forth. So how do we intervene in ways that strengthen what works rather than replacing it wholesale? How do we recognize that cities are already adaptive? They are already innovative, already engaged in forms of reuse, just perhaps not always in the same ways as they would be framed in formal planning narratives and expectations or in the latest technical or sustainability agenda. So, you will have understood, I am no longer an architect, but an academic, so this gives me the privilege to ask questions of which I don't know the answers. And we would typically take many years to come up with an answer, and we will want to evaluate in the most rigorous way in many years to come the outcomes of your, you know, the mid to long-term outcomes of your projects. It was definitely very refreshing and very inspiring to see these young collectives, these young architects, trying to give answers of their own. So please join me in saying thank you very much to you for your presentation.
Would you like to also?
Sure, I'll probably stay here then.
Sure.
So given the time, and I don't want to occupy too much time, and Martina has already said so many useful and intelligent things, I don't want to really go deep into this. Before coming into academia, I used to be an engineer myself, and before switching into social science, I used to work in an engineering and construction firm, working side by side with engineers and architects. So I have huge respect for architecture. So let me just put that in the upfront. I also believe the whole idea of creative reuse are really important, especially in the age of increasing importance of urban sustainability and so on. So all of these, I don't really have anything to dispute. But after all, the event is here taking place in the School of Economics and political science, and I really want to kind of bring in economics and politics in all of these. And let me try to be as brief as I can. I talk about these issues of politics and economics largely as someone who's been studying China and South Korea and other parts of Asia almost 3 decades now. Looking at how the rapidly expanding cities in China came to consume a lot of cement and a lot of the energy, which probably go against what you say here. So I think you're saying, you start your presentation by saying there are regions, cases when preservation or reuse is simply not possible, when materials are too damaged to fix, when urban needs to evolve, or when history itself is layered with erasure. I would probably say there are other regions also which are related to the state logics and also the market logics, which actually prevent such preservation or reuse almost impossible. And I think Martina, having talked about this incremental urbanism, temporary urbanism, fits quite nicely with what I hope to say, largely because I'm not denying incremental urbanism doesn't exist in China or Asia. Of course, it's there, and there's a lot of adaptation, reuse, and so on. But there's also huge demand for rebuild and demolition as well. So in China, for example, experts estimate that half of world cement production in 2023 was by China, and also between 2011 and 2013, the consumption of cement by China was almost equivalent to the entire consumption of cement by the U.S. in the 20th century. So that's a huge amount of consumption of cement, which goes into buildings, new buildings, infrastructure, and so on and so forth, to enable the whole rise of these mega cities, which are also aligning with the improving living conditions and so on, who are looking for better house and a larger house or different ways of living, breaking ties with the past. So in this kind of framing, I was kind of wondering whether the kind of experiences of Asian economies like China and South Korea in the second half of 20th century and early part of the 21st century, how much we can learn from those in order to think about what creative reuse can apply. So I'm here kind of thinking about why we acknowledge the importance of creative reuse. There are many of these economic and political contexts within which creative reuse cannot be somehow maintained. So I'm just kind of bringing up those, so not really negating what you say, but kind of expanding our discussions here. So there are reasons why buildings don't get reused. So on the one hand, there's probably the logic of the state, especially local state, which also benefits very hugely from rebuilding demolition, like in China, where land being put into profitable use becomes a major important source of fiscal revenue generation for local government, and therefore they constantly incentivize such demolition and reconstruction rather than creative reuse itself. There's also the land value capture and profit maximization, which I'm sure you're all aware as an architect operating within markets. But I think this also becomes quite important because the whole drive for reconstruction and demolition doesn't allow buildings to really exist to reach the lifespan of these concrete buildings. You are the expert, so you can probably correct me, but usually we think of 50 to 70 years when concrete buildings are built and put into use. But in Korea, people probably start thinking about residential buildings when they reach the residential condominiums, when they reach 20 or 30 years of lifetime, then they start thinking about demolition and reconstruction. In China, also the same, 20 to 25 to 30 years, they start thinking about not extending the use of the buildings by creative reuse, but or enhancing other structural deficiencies, but basically in the demolition and reconstruction. And those are also further strengthened by people's aspiration to accumulate, and they kind of look for building and demolition and rebuilding do allow people who have ownership of properties to gain more by enabling this whole rebuilding and demolition, to make way for more profitable and more highly valued new properties. So people are kind of opposing very often the whole reuse and extending the old buildings by another 20 years to keep it in the market, sometimes go against the people's wish. So all of these are basically telling us where creative reuse, why very important and important also for sustainability. Seems to face a lot of limitations in these conditions. And I think these economies are pretty much having very different market dynamics, political dynamics, in comparison with what you have shared here today in the European context. So coming to conclusion, some questions, Martina, if the political economy rewards redevelopment turnover, such as land finance or reconstruction premiums, how does reuse compete with the revenue models? What are the regulatory frameworks that would facilitate reuse? So if you kind of want to extend this to different political and economic context, where the regulatory frameworks are quite different from what, the markets that you're more familiar with, what would be your recommendations? What would be the kind of enablers for such creative reuse to kick in, rather than kind of moral imperatives to be emphasized? Finally, how does your framework travel to cities where the state is not simply a regulator outside the market, but like in China, state itself is within the market, creating market instruments, and therefore they have less incentives to really pursue what can be important from more sustainability point of view. So I guess I stop there and hand over to you.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ian and Martina, for this insightful comment. Questions for Andre. I echo some of them. I had chopped it down very similar points while you were talking. So I'll give you an opportunity to at least react before opening to questions from the floor.
I'll try. Thank you very much. I would like to touch what you said, because we never see the building as one single element. It's a collection of of several layers on top of each other, even a new built building, and the load bearing structure, which is the most in which we tend to have the most the highest percentage of embodied carbon, for instance, is just a slice of entire building. It's like 20%, maybe 15%, and the rest is potentially replaceable without any drastic damages for the environment, because the other layers, as facade, as partition walls, as furniture, finishes, are not that CO2 heavy as concrete, for instance. So my suggestion would be to think in these terms, and if the political economy in certain regions is willing to build anew, maybe there's the market of these 80% of buildings of the content of the buildings, which is replaceable in maybe short time, in like 20-30 years, but the load-bearing structure could be designed in a very flexible way to accommodate any function of the future.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Do you have any reaction to Martina's point, or shall I open?
Could you tell me again?
I mean, it was more like a provocation. How do we make sure as professionals that we already recognize the creative reuse that is ongoing in cities, innovation and creativity of communities?
If you could recognize that.
Do you think that many professionals do look at that?
That's a good question. I think we should, because I think architects tend to work with context, and context is always about lots of things, but the reuse is very contemporary context. And I like what you said, that the cities are unfinished projects, never finished projects, and this is really important to consider and to think about our cities as constantly changing environments, and they are much more changing than the nature or vernacular areas, rural areas. So I think it's becoming very obvious. There are also tendencies across Europe that we should stop demolitions completely. I think you heard about the program. We are just collecting voices, and if we would gain 1 million voices, the European Commission has to take it into the consideration. I don't know what is the status now, but it's actually happening. To not just to blame the demolitions, but to actually stop them. So I think it's a societal change, and architects are completely aware of this. Maybe not in every single region around the world, but I like Muyawa Oki's quotation that architects should be the agents of change. So this is what we do.
Very much. I think we've got about 20 minutes to open the floor up for questions. If you want to ask a question, please raise your hands, and maybe I'll take two or three. I can see three hands up. We can take them all together. If you don't mind, say your name and one word of background, and keep the question to a question rather than a rambling statement about what you think.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for an engaging presentation and discussion. My name is Gleb Kerin. I'm currently a student at the Real Estate and Real Estate Economics and Finance with previous experience in commercial real estate lending. And my question is the following. So we have discussed many benefits of redevelopments, revitalization, and I'm fully in favor of that. At the same time, we also see that redevelopments can often be more costly than complete new ground-up developments, and sometimes they take more time. Due diligence may be longer and all of the other elements of the process. So given that, and given the housing crisis, which we see in many cities around Europe, and the desperate need to deliver new housing units, do you think the government and local public authorities may actually be in favor of moving away from the retrofit first principle and actually encouraging quicker demolitions, new developments, or do you think still we are on track for redevelopments and this track will keep going? Thank you.
Got a couple of questions. It was somewhere towards the back.
Yeah, hi, my name's Amin, I'm an architect. If you begin with the thought experiment that if you're building in timber or biomass material and you're sequestering carbon by material passporting, the thought experiment is that you can build more in timber. You can sequester as much carbon as possible, and building more does better than doing nothing at all. But start with that thought experiment and then count the embodied carbon on those, on the impact of your particular projects or your future projects. How would you approach your material counting, your carbon counting?
I thought there was another question somewhere in the middle.
Hi, I'm Emily and I work for a company called Zettler. And I was just kind of interested to maybe hear some kind of learnings or international case studies that we could maybe bring to here in London, where sometimes it feels like housing building is stalled, and how we kind of look after our city or change our city is very bureaucratic and we don't have kind of community power necessarily. I know there's some councillors here, so interested to hear their opinion as well. But yeah, it's just interesting to know if there's any international examples where communities have maybe added a layer to the city and how we could maybe be inspired here as Londoners and maybe apply some of that here.
Thank you very much. I think the question was about international example of where community has been helpful in enabling this creative reuse of cities. Is that what you have in mind?
Yeah. Okay. Retrofit first. I think if you. We have an example. We are working on a project which is an 11-story tall building, an office building built 15 years ago, and the client is willing to change the zoning and change the function to resi. And he came up with the calculation that time-wise it's quicker than to demolish and build from the scratch, because if you can close the facade, you can work independently inside and outside. So you save actually time, and this was for me quite new information, and I was really wondering why they chosen retrofit first. So it's case by case, and there are some areas which has to be removed, of course, like. Every radical statement is radical statement, but this save on time was actually the driver for profit-driven developer to keep the building. So that's quite interesting fact. Material counting. How we gonna count the CO2 footprint, or if I did understood correctly? How we gonna drop it? We have in the portfolio, it was in the presentation, the project for Czech Forestry Commission. It's a company responsible for all the forests in the country, and we are carefully calculating the footprint of the building. It's completely built from scratch, almost on the green field. That's their, the land is their property for ages, but they chosen to build their headquarters, and they want to make a benchmark of CO2 negative building. So it's completely out of timber. We calculate the frames of the windows. We calculate the glass, etc. The biggest problem is the foundations, because it has to be out of concrete, and you have to. We have still this weird legislation in Central Europe that you have to park cars in garages. That nothing compares to London. That you have, you are free of garages at all, and this is magic. This is really, really, really forward thinking strategy. So it's tough, but we are trying hard, because I think we have just this one experience, and it's not easy, honestly speaking. And the third one, examples, once again. I'm not used to this, so I'm always answering the question one by one.
We go that way. Example, international example of where community helped in supporting the creative reuse of cities.
I think communities are very strong. And we had really nice example in Prague, where we work on the riverbank of Vltava River, where the local community was completely against any construction on the riverbank, and but there was a huge pressure because the land was very expensive, and it was sold three times to three different developers. And the last one, compared to the other ones, went in very transparent way, where he invited local community to the participative process. And we experienced a year before they announced the winner of the competition, architecture competition, talking to local community and carefully asking them what's the biggest problem, it was not just not in my courtyard, it was literally, they were afraid that they will lose contact with the river, they were afraid that they will lose their local atmosphere. And when we spoken to them, we realized that they were missing one important aspect of their existing neighborhood, and they were missing a central plaza, center square, because they were constantly asking about, we would like to have somewhere a cafe and restaurant and maybe some grocery shop, etc. And for an architect, it was a great information, because we, in Central Europe, even here in London, you have these like high streets, but in Central Europe, we have squares. We do not just protest there, but we are also considering the squares as subcenters of our cities, or major spaces where we can find this these amenities. So we came up with the idea to bring a new square within the existing within a new master plan, which would be dedicated not to the newcomers, but also to the local community. And they accepted this idea, but without them, it wouldn't be possible to create this public space, which was actually inside the development. So, yeah.
Thank you very much. Are there any more questions from the audience? Here at the front, we'll go one by one. This time, at least Andrei doesn't get frustrated with it.
Is this on? I'm John Morgan. I'm an alumni from the Cities Program, and I did promise Andrea a difficult question. Obviously, it's difficult coming as an architect, giving an architectural presentation in a school of social and political science. So I guess what I'm trying to understand is that the question really about the creative reuse of cities. You know, part of it, I'm wondering, is it the brief that drives it, or do you have a methodology or sort of five principles that you would have, like Le Corbusier, to say, these are the five things that we do in each project to create sort of tangible targets or things that we can measure and look back on for the success or failure of the project? Thank you.
This is a tough question. I would say we work within the case studies. This is where we collect data and where we collect where we're building our knowledge. And it's not articulated into 5 points yet. I think we are working on it. We just established our research department within the studio, led by PhD students of urban design and planning. And it's ongoing process, but we have already enough data to evaluate first results. So it's actually happening, but there's not like five things we would always do to fulfill the criteria. Next lecture, maybe.
Thank you very much.
Give me 15 years, next 15 years, please.
Hi, I'm Emily. I'm a student now, but I previously worked on land use reform issues at a think tank. And I've been thinking a lot about data centers. And I was wondering if, in terms of creative reuse, if you have any thoughts or opinions on the life cycle of these really enormous sites, and all of the acreage that they take up, and just how we are going to be able to cope with what will, I think, probably pretty quickly become big empty shells of buildings.
The data centers?
Yes.
I will put it vice versa, because I have no idea what we're going to do with the garages under our buildings in Europe. So maybe there would be like a nice space for data centers in the future. Because there's no other function possible, maybe some like delivery, like decentralized delivery spaces. But this is a huge topic, I have to say. And is it possible to build them inside the cities? Like, I never had any experience with data centers, so it's maybe we can talk later.
Fantastic. Any more questions from the audience? One over here.
Hi, I'm Ellie, I'm a PhD student, and you spoke a bit about working in areas that were considered no-go zones. Just wondering if you could speak a bit about best practice in places that have become stigmatized.
Stigmatized. I think it was stigmatized territory. As I said, it was. It has a name, ghetto. It's a ghetto fest, etc., etc. And the stigmatization was happening there last 30 years because of many reasons. And I think the project I've introduced is trying to destigmatize the neighborhood, because one aspect of the destigmatization is gentrification, but the other hand is to balance the gentrification while working as conscious as possible within it. Stigmatization is the biggest problem. I think, honestly speaking, the territory was the district was more stigmatized than the real threat was happening there.
Thank you very much. Any other question? I have a little follow-up question on that. It has been booming in my mind since you started off your presentation, which sort of follows on a little bit from the answer you gave to the colleague over there, which has to do with this idea that you are at the same time reinventing and preserving, trying to keep the memories. But it feels there is a tension between the idea of reinventing, rejuvenating the neighborhood, and maintaining the memories, where, as you said, there is a fine balance to be struck between keeping the old and at the same time gentrifying. So how do you go about approaching this fine-tuning job of making sure that the memories is still alive through the people that live in the neighborhood, as well as rejuvenating, which very often would come at the cost of some of these people moving out? And I think Martina also touched upon these issues in her comments.
I think it's never happening in architect's mind. It's about a very transparent process. You have to be very transparent with local community and stakeholders you just have to be very open, and then you have to carefully select relevant aspects of the debate and try to combine them into architecture. But what I really love is the combination of old and new. This is something. If we had this gradient, I tend to be somewhere in the middle to follow and keep as much as possible, but also to bring some new breath and new layer in it, because I think there's still right to do so.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think we were told we need to finish at 8 sharp, so unless there are any pressing questions, I think we should wrap the event up. Thank you very much for the plenty of questions. Thank you very much, Martina Hune and Andre, for your great intervention. It's been a pleasure to chair the session, and thanks a lot again for coming.